Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, am I coming home? Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I hope when you hear these words, your gray turns blue, gray turns blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I care, and I won't let go. Even though we're oceans away, you're
another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon, and I want to welcome everybody on this 25th day of December, the year 2009, for a special episode. We're going to be delving into the origins of this very, very religious holiday known as Christmas. We're going to be delving into the origins of that. We're going to be delving into some of the origins of Christianity, I would actually say, yeah, without a doubt, some of the things that we'll be delving into on all fronts today are not commonly known or not commonly believed by mainstream society, especially here in the West. Right here in the belly of the beast, probably the epicenter of the capitalistic world, United States of America, this is a very, very most capitalistic, bastardized holiday. And we're going to be getting into that. We're going to be getting into stuff that may question a lot of people's faith, what they've been told and what they're taught. But, you know, when has the truth not mattered? And as they say, the truth shall set you free. So we'll be joined in a few minutes from Arizona by a comrade of mine who's actually a man of the cloth, who will be talking about Christianity in a most non-mainstream light. And we'll be joined by a young scholar in the Washington D.C. metropolitan area who's going to be talking about different aspects of this so-called holiday, the 25th of December, and getting into the whole myth and lore around the birth of Jesus Christ. Those of us who have actually read, and studied the Bible, we know that this is not the day that Jesus Christ was born, Yahshua ben Yosef. So, but before we get into that dialogue, and we ask that if you want to call in, definitely feel free to call in. You can call any time during the show. If you end up listening to this after the 25th, by that time it will be pre-recorded, so you won't be able to call in. But if you're listening right now live at on the 25th of December 2009, 2 p.m., 2:06 Eastern Standard Time, you are more than welcome to call in at any point during the show and engage yourself with me and the guests. And the call-in number is 347-945-5191. Once again, that's 347-945-5191. But before we get into that, I want to cover a couple things in terms of current events and news that from a very non-corporate mainstream media perspective, as we always do. We're kind of the antithesis to what you would expect to hear or see on the corporate mainstream Western media. One of those things, before I get into it, is interesting, this whole, and I guess maybe I'll table it for a little bit later in the show, but this whole healthcare debate that has been just been lagging and being trudged along for the last few months, and it's one of the more despicable aspects of this super capitalist society that we live in, called the United States of America, is that there's a few places, only in a few places in the world can you expect to see this battle over healthcare go on like it has been going on, and this bill that was just signed or is about to be signed into law, the health insurance reform. There's a big difference between healthcare and health insurance, and even the President of the United States of America, Obama himself, said it's the health reform, the health insurance reform bill. And he's been more than willing to chime in and to allow himself, allow himself to be co-opted by corporate America, first Wall Street and now by big pharma, as well as these big health insurance corporations who have now been awarded. They are the ones that have truly won. They have, without a doubt, it's a win-win for them. The populace of America has lost. If you tune into the mainstream media, it might portray it in a way that you might think that the people have won, but they have lost. The big insurance companies, they are the winners. They get mandated. They have a piece of crap product that now millions upon millions of American citizens are going to be mandated to actually buy that. So it's that, I kind of liken it to going to a car dealership, and there's a piece of junk in the corner of the lot, and someone tells you, you must buy that. You must buy that junky car with the two flat tires, broken, windshield, busted headlights, broken radiator. That is what has been passed down. It is a piece of crap bill, and you know it's all stems around money. You know, it has nothing to do with the welfare of people. You know, to the tune of 44,000+ people die each and every single year in America because of lack of adequate health care, adequate health care and lack of health insurance. And so, you know, it's just you know, I don't know what else to say about it. It's one of the more despicable and disgusting aspects of American society. You know, it is without a doubt profit over the people. So, you know, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Hopefully, you know, some of you guys that may call in may chime in on that. But I think making that connection between this capitalistic society and how capitalism has won over in this healthcare debate, won over the interests of the people, I think it's great. It's a great segue, you know, when we do, to segue that into this Christmas holiday, the 25th of December, because this is a most capitalistic, consumer-based holiday in every aspect. And we'll get into that. You know, we'll get more and more into that. So, but I want to play a couple of clips that I got from Brother Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report. And if you haven't heard, as I say each week, if you have not checked out blackagendareport.com, you need to make sure that that's part of your weekly reading and support Glenn Ford and Bruce Dixon and that website. You know, it's very important that we support strong media outlets like that. So the Copenhagen 15 just ended, and I have my own thoughts and views about that. But I'll let Glenn Ford take it, and I'll see you on the other side of this news clip.
The United States, having reaped more benefits than any other nation from the industrial warming of planet Earth, now seeks to turn the resulting global disaster to its own advantage, or more precisely, to the advantage of the U.S.-based amoral, world-annihilating corporate class. In Copenhagen last week, the Obama administration destroyed any chance of averting catastrophe in Africa and the developing nations of the global South. Temperatures will be allowed to rise 2 degrees Celsius on average, which translates to 3.5 degrees in the hotter latitudes. As a consequence, said Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Africa is to be condemned to incineration and no modern development. What development does occur would be at the pleasure of the United States and Europe. President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went to Copenhagen to end any possibility of a global agreement on greenhouse gases that rich nations would be bound to respect. Obama administered the coup de grace to the Kyoto Accords, extinguishing all hope of an international agreement that respects the rights of all nations to develop their economies within a binding framework that protects everybody's interests. Instead, the United States imposed its own take-it-or-leave-it ultimatum: accept the inevitability of catastrophe in Africa and across the global South, and also accept that the U.S. and its corporations will dictate how the developing world will be allowed to grow its economies. Refuse, and the uppity poor countries will be cut off from the rich man's aid. This is disaster capitalism in its most hellish form. The term was coined by political writer Naomi Klein in 2005, to describe how the International Monetary Fund induced or exploited economic disasters in the Third World and then forced poor countries to surrender their national sovereignty in order to be eligible for loans and aid from the rich countries. The aim was to make it impossible for poor countries to control their own economic and political destinies. The United States went to Copenhagen intent on imposing a disaster capitalism regime on the poor nations of the planet. While Africa burns, Washington gives up nothing in terms of binding commitments. Instead, the U.S. offers, but does not guarantee or even promise, to create a special fund, possibly eventually amounting to $100 billion, from which aid will be doled out. The rich nations will determine who gets a piece of the global warming aid pie and under what terms. The Americans insist that some of the money will come from private sources, rich corporations that are answerable to no one but their own greedy selves, which means Western businessmen will determine how Africa and the global South will be allowed to develop under conditions of climate change. The U.S. reserves the right to make separate deals with favored nations, that is, countries whose leaders surrender their national destiny to the developmental wishes of the West. Disaster capitalism holds the most vulnerable of the world's people hostage to imperial blackmail at the hour of the planet's greatest peril. It is a crime against humanity, and most grievously, a crime against Africa. How ironic that the chief perpetrator of the crime is himself a son of Africa. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
I have one more clip before we're joined by Desta Anuel, who's on the line right now, and maybe I'll get his input on that clip as well as this clip. But, you know, those of us who have yet to take the blue pill, you know, that reference coming from The Matrix, and Glenn Ford made a reference to Naomi Klein. There's a book that she wrote called The Shock Doctrine. I had the opportunity to read that book, and it's a very, very enlightening book, and it gets into disaster capitalism and how disaster capitalism, you know, reared its ugly head and everywhere from New Orleans, where you had, you know, disciples of Milton Friedman from the, you know, Chicago School, you know, tried to, and it looks like successfully implement their disaster capitalism in New Orleans, all the way to, you know, she discusses even how after the huge tsunami in Southeast Asia, in terms of how that was used to get natives from, you know, off the beaches so that they could start to build tourist sites and hotels and so forth under the guise of this tsunami that really played a large role in helping them do what they wanted to do all along. And so I want to play this clip because this also is connected to America's, you know, rapacious greed and hunger for the bottom line and as much money as they can, you know, those, you know, from everyone from the 1% that control more wealth than the bottom 90% to even the top 10% that control the vast majority of the wealth in this country. And, you know, and many of those folks are those folks that were voting on this piece of crap health insurance reform bill that puts big pharma and big health insurance companies feet first, puts them completely ahead of folks who are dying on a day-to-day basis. As I said before, 44,000 plus people die each year because of lack of health care as well as health insurance. So I just want to play this clip because it has a lot to do with this war, this illegal war and invasion in Afghanistan right now, and its connection to privatized military and so forth. And then when we come back, we'll be joined by Desta Anuel, who's on the line right now, and we'll hit the ground running. We'll get into many, many things, not least of which is this so-called holiday, the 25th of December, the so-called birth of the prophet Jesus Christ.
It is now beyond question that civilian military contractors, mercenaries, are permanently embedded in the structure and long-term planning of the United States Armed Forces. In recent years, about half the U.S. personnel in the combined South Asia theaters of war, Afghanistan and Pakistan, have been civilians, according to Pentagon figures. The 1-to-1 ratio of military to civilians, a percentage that would have been unthinkable prior to the invasion of Iraq, may become even more lopsidedly mercenary with President Obama's troop escalation in Afghanistan. The Congressional Research Service estimates that as many as 56,000 civilian contractors may accompany the 30,000 uniformed troops scheduled for deployment to Afghanistan. That's a ratio of almost 2-to-1 civilian to military. The Afghanistan-Pakistan Theater has become the world's first modern, large-scale, corporate civilian war. The official statistics on civilians in war zones do not include covert operations, or black ops, which have been steadily increasing since President Obama took office, especially in Pakistan. The Pakistani military is extremely sensitive to the influx of thousands of American mercenaries. Much of the Pakistani press and public believe the Americans are sneaking in mercenaries to threaten the Pakistani state and seize its nuclear arsenal, which is likely one reason the Pakistanis have systematically delayed the processing of American travel documents. The mercenary outfit, formerly known as Blackwater, is one of the most hated names in Pakistan. For the United States, war has devolved to a matter of contracts, a multi-trillion dollar cash cow for corporations, a self-perpetuating financial bubble that feeds the planet's most dangerous and non-productive, useless classes. Ever since the near disintegration of the U.S. military in Vietnam, the rulers of the United States have schemed to make war an activity that directly touches only a small proportion of the population. In 1972, the all-volunteer system made it possible for the Pentagon to socially engineer the demographics of the military. In the post-9/11 era, as any viewer of PBS NewsHour can observe, the troops most likely to die are small-town whites and Latinos, demographics that are not prone to political protest and, at any rate, wield little power in American society. To put it bluntly, those who are most likely to be killed in U.S. wars are from families and towns that are least likely to complain and are in no position to protest effectively anyway. Recent brown immigrants and white kids from Nowheresville are precious to the Pentagon precisely because they present so few political problems. Mercenaries are even better, ideal. The vast majority have already been trained in the combat arms. They are separate from the military chain of command, which can always disavow their crimes with no prejudice to the honor of the uniformed services. Most importantly, the mercenary war is a simple commercial transaction, a private affair between employee and management, and none of the general public's business. Notions of democracy, shared national culpability, citizens' obligations to one another and to the human species, none of this enters the equation in corporate war making. It is pure killing for profit, or pure profit for killing on an industrial scale. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
So as I said, please, please make sure you support blackagendareport.com because that's hard-hitting critical analysis that you simply will not get from the mainstream corporate news. They don't even come close to trying to approach very important geopolitical matters, any kind of critical analysis, analytical way that might engage the regular layperson to understand what the hell is going on. But you know what? Based on their motives, that would be counterintuitive to who they are because it really pays for the power elite and, for all intents and purposes, those that control the media are the power elite. It really pays them, literally pays them to have regular folks not to be engaged and not to understand these critical issues and their full complexity. And so without further ado, I'm joined by Desta Anuo, and I also see I have Peter Fowler on the line from joining us from sunny Arizona. I assume it's sunny there today. And if my good friend, Dest Anuel. If you could introduce yourself, tell the listeners who you are, and if you want to chime in and say a couple words about what you think about, you know, Obama and the and Congress's new health care, or health insurance reform act.
How you doing, Solomon? My name is Dest Anuel. I'm a student at the University of Maryland. I also host a show on Blog Talk Radio called Evo Queno Radio. And yeah, as far as the situation with the Obama so-called health reform, I mean, I kind of saw this coming from the jump. Unfortunately, Barack Obama is a seller of dreams. He's not really someone who actually has any real conviction or anything. He's just a corporate puppet. And he tells people what they really want to hear. From the very beginning, he was reneging on the different things that he was saying he was going to do. One of the first times that people were in trouble was the fact that he took single payer off the table. And once you take single payer off the table, there's not really much left to compromise on or negotiate besides the public option. And the public option was the main thing that was going forward, you know, that was supposed to be the reform. The Americans would now be able to be covered, and if they couldn't pay for the private insurance, the government could take care of it. And he couldn't even deliver on that. And so what is the reform now? There really is no reform. It's basically like being forced to buy a bad product.
Right.
And I'm not really sure how this guy with a straight face can go and defend this. I mean, he even had the audacity to say that he never campaigned on a public option. And
yeah.
I was stunned that he could even say something like that. And so this just goes to show that this guy can't be trusted. I mean, he's just a liar. We thought John Kerry was bad at flip-flopping. This guy is the king of flip-floppers.
You're right. You're so right on that. And how can he do that? He can do that because that Obama aid punch, that Obama aid Kool-Aid that millions upon millions drank. You know, some strong SHIT, man. That's a potent drug, man. That's a potent drug, and you know, that's why, you know, I'm starting to really become critical of those folks who clearly, unconditionally, support this dude. It's one thing that you were sold on this, you know, on the whole thing. I, you know, can understand that after you know, 8 years of the Bush-Cheney-Gunter, you know, regime, but you know, even though Obama, you know, during his election campaign, he was telling us that he was going to do exactly what he's doing, and you know, that's escalate the war in Afghanistan, you know, and so many people thought that he was an anti-war candidate. He wasn't. He was a pro-camp war candidate, and that's why I chose to vote for Cynthia McKinney, and you know, because of that, I can look myself in the mirror every day when I wake up that I made the right choice and I didn't vote for this scoundrel. But you know, but after a while, when he starts to continue to do the same things that the previous administration made its name on, and you still support this guy, and you still, you know, are unwilling to you know, critically assess this guy's job, and to see that he is, as you said, Desta, you know, basically a bold-faced liar. You know, criticism, you know, it should be definitely spread on those Obamites or Obamanistas, you know, very strongly, because those are the folks that it's, you know, it's deplorable. And so, you know, you're exactly right. In 2005, when he was, as you said, Dustin, when he was a state senator, he was for single payer. In Chicago, he was for single payer. And when this whole thing started with, you know, on the cold campaign trail, as you alluded to, Dustin, he said he was for single payer. And what has happened now? He had totally, as each step went along the way, he slowly capitulated and moved further and further away from those stances to the point where we see that, you know, the people that, you know, supported him to the tune of millions of dollars, you know, folks from the healthcare industry, big pharma. If you go to opensecrets.org, or it's either .org or .com, just Google Open Secrets, you can easily see and trace where the $745 million that he had in his campaign war chest. You can see exactly where that money came from, and the proof, as they say, is in the pudding. And so I'm glad to be joined by you, Desta. Desta also, you know, don't let his age fool you. You know, he's He's a double major at the University of Maryland. He just received his degree in African American Studies, and this May he'll be receiving his second degree in engineering. But don't let the age fool you. He's a scholar, a good friend of mine, and he's, you know, and the reason I, you know, one of the reasons I have him on the show, even though, you know, I could have Des on the show as I've had before, we could talk about current issues and current events, but one of his particular areas of interest is religion. I mean, he's been studying African religion as well as Western religion, and you know, I brought him on the show because he's going to provide a unique perspective in terms of looking at the actual origins of what we now call Christianity, but first and foremost, looking at this this holiday, so-called holiday called Christmas, and so we're also joined by Keith Fowler, and Keith, could you tell listeners who you are? And there's a specific reason why, a couple of specific reasons why I had Keith join us today. So if Keith, you could introduce yourself and actually tell the listeners where your particular background comes in terms of Christianity, because, you know, I think it's important for folks to know that, you know, where you studied and what makes you an expert on Christianity, the real the story, not the mythological one.
Yeah, how you doing, Solomon? This is Peter Fowler calling from Glendale, Arizona, and I appreciate the invitation to be with you today. And it's exciting for me to be able to spend the so-called Christmas holiday talking about the real deal behind Christmas. And my background, I have a Master in Divinity from the United Theological Seminary in Dayton, Ohio. I also studied at McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago, and I have a BSSW from Ohio State in Columbus. And I like to think of myself as a scholar practitioner, in that on the practitioner side, I've actually been in ministry. I've done ministry at the church level. I've been a jail chaplain, done ministry in other areas of corrections, as well as youth ministry. And for several years in the 90s, I was Minister of Outreach at Omega Baptist Church, which is the largest African-American Baptist church in Dayton, Ohio. And I've evolved along my journey as a minister and as a Christian, and to the point now where I consider myself a follower of Jesus of Nazareth. And the Christianity that we see today, American Christianity, or what I like to call instead churchianity, is a bastardization or a corruption of the authentic Jesus movement. And so I've gotten to a point in my faith and my convictions about Jesus of Nazareth that are wholly at odds with mainstream Christianity, particularly American Christianity. And it's appropriate that you started your show with some dialogue about what's going on in the news, current events, talking about the Obama misadministration and their attempt at health care reform, and also Glenn Ford's insights, because we have to look at Christianity, particularly Christianity in America, in context. And we have to understand Christianity in America in the 21st century, in its historical context, as it developed in Europe over the last 15 to 1700 years. And again, it's very different from the authentic Jesus movement, and it's very different from what my colleague you also have on the show today is, I'm sure, going to talk about in terms of the origins of Christianity and the African origins of Christianity, the African impact on Christianity. So that's where I'm coming from, Solomon. And I think we need to talk about Christmas in that bigger context.
Thank you. That's a perfect segue. And as you alluded to, Peter, you kind of set the table for this dialogue to really start off talking about Christianity. I mean, Christmas, since you know we're having this dialogue on the 25th of December 2009. And Desta, you know, you being the younger of the two, I'll let you open things up if you want to open up with your thoughts and your research and studies and what what you've come to believe and understand about Christmas.
Okay. I guess the very first thing I can say is that there truly really isn't anything new under the sun. Everything that we do now has already been done by different names. What we call Christmas today, a couple of thousand years ago, people called Yule. If you were like in the Germanic area, people called Sol Invictus, if you want to Roman times, or people called different things, no matter what. But what often happens is that a group of people will go and claim exclusive rights to something. They try and copyright it, and then they repackage it and sell it to the rest of the world. And that's essentially what's gone on with Christmas. Christmas has its beginnings before Christ, I would say, interesting enough. Before the person named as Jesus Christ was born, people were celebrating Christmas. And so you might ask, why? How could that happen? Well, the thing about Christmas is very odd is that it's set around an occurrence called the winter solstice. Now, the winter solstice begins around December 21st, December 22nd, depending on the year, and it involves the sun. That's the time when the sun is at its lowest point in the sky. So the sun will get to its lowest point in the sky around December 21st or the 22nd. It will then, quote unquote, die, you know, remain dead for 3 days, and then around December 25th, it will start rising up again. So in order to go and commemorate this event, ancient cultures who were primarily agricultural based went and had festivals around this time. So like I said, in the Germanic tribes of Europe, they had Yule. In the Roman places, they had Sol Invictus, and Sol was the name of the sun, and Invictus means unconquerable. It's called unconquerable sun, and so that's how they went and had their celebration. And that's what happened. That's what occurred throughout most of the ancient world. But what happened is that the Roman Empire, after Constantine became a Christian, decided to go and try and form a new religion to go and conquer, to unite the empire. And so essentially, most of the Roman world, the Roman Empire was, they practiced their natural religion. That's where pagan comes from. Pagan just means nature. And so they already had these traditions. So rather than go and force them to adopt new traditions, essentially went and repackaged the old traditions, made them new, and thus created what we call Christianity today. So you take a look at the Christmas tree, and you wonder, what does that have to do with Jesus or anything else that's supposed to be going on with Christmas? And the answer is it has absolutely nothing to do with it. It's taken from Yule. And the same thing with the wreath, Santa Claus and the rest of these things were pre-Christian elements mostly from Europe that crept their way into the package holiday called Christmas.
Thank you. Thank you for that insight. And Peter, I'd like to ask you if the Christmas tree has nothing to do with Christmas, and, I was actually watching the television last night, and I had all these. I saw on at least a couple different shows, folks on the various programs, and this was mainstream, TV. So you're talking about tens of millions of viewers, basically saying that they were talking about they're giving their different perspectives and talking about the fact that they're looking forward to tomorrow. As I said, this was last night. So they're looking forward to today to celebrate, the day that Jesus Christ was born on. And so both you guys have alluded to the fact that made inferences that Jesus was not born on this day. Am I correct, Peter? And if
oh,
I'm
yeah,
correct,
absolutely.
When was he born?
That's absolutely correct. Scholars are at a loss to try to come up with an exact date when Jesus was born. You've got to understand, again, contextually, that Jesus was a peasant. His family was peasantry. They were Jewish peasants, Palestinians living under Roman occupation in the worst exploitative conditions you could possibly imagine in the first century under a horrifically oppressive Roman rule. So, you know, Jesus was a nobody. He was a nobody. Jesus' family was nobodies. And so there's really no way to have any record of the birth of someone like that. I mean, if you think about a parallel to that, think about some of the Africans who were enslaved in the United States. And one of the things that was most difficult for Black Americans is to go back and find out when their ancestors were born, where their people were from, because they were considered to be nobodies. And Jesus of Nazareth was born into that type of contextual cultural milieu. So there's really no way, there's no accurate way to find out when Jesus was born. And, you know, the bottom line is it's really insignificant. It really doesn't matter. But what my colleague just pointed out to, and tell me your name again, brother.
Desta.
Desta. Desta brought up a historical character who is significant in the history of Christianity, and particularly the direction that Christianity took under the Roman Empire. He mentioned Constantine. You know, Constantine was a Roman emperor, and what Constantine did was adopt Christianity as his personal religion. And prior to Constantine, Christianity was illegal in the Roman Empire. That's where the stories, and they're accurate stories, this is factual history, where Christians were, you've heard the term, being thrown to the lions. Well, the Romans would go out and capture anybody who didn't confess that Caesar was Lord. And Christians, authentic Christians, were the ones who refused to do that. They followed Jesus. And so that's why the term Jesus is Lord carried such weight back in the day. At one time it did. Today it's meaningless. It's just it's a catchphrase or a catchphrase today. But under Constantine, he changed all that. He made Christianity legal in the Roman Empire, and he adopted it as his own religion. And he opened the door for Christianity later, under a later emperor, to become the official religion of the Roman Empire, and therefore opened the floodgates for Christianity to become institutionalized, the bedfellow of the Roman Empire across Europe, and of course, eventually the Americas, when the European empire moved across the ocean to the west. But what I call, Solomon, that event or that period of time is the Constantinian corruption, or better yet, the Constantinian castration of Christianity. Because what had been a peasant movement, a movement of the underclass, a real rebellion, a revolt by the underclass, was co-opted by the empire with the emperor as its lead spokesman, and it became something completely different. And just like Desta was talking about, how some of these pre-Christian and non-Christian traditions and observances like the solstice observance and the Yule and the various observances across different cultures, those were co-opted into the Christian story, the story of Christmas. And so it's the narrative that has become so important. And in the telling of that narrative over the centuries, the facts of history have become lost, and at this point are considered secondary or even unnecessary by American Christianity. The fact that, you know, December 25th was not the actual date of Jesus' birth, you know, we just kind of overlook that. The fact that the tree in most people's homes this time of year has nothing whatsoever to do with Jesus of Nazareth, we overlook that because Christmas in America and across much of the West has become co-opted and become this syncretistic religion that comprises so much of a non-Christian or non-Jesus movement element to it.
Right, and I was going to ask you guys, like, that's a good point that both of you guys brought up, because it seems that, as you were alluding to, Peter, it has this faith has such a strong hold, and and you talked about the co-optation, you know, of the movement by Constantine himself, and today you see the co-optation, it seems, of people's minds, their ability to even critically think about things that just don't make sense. I've seen this time and time again. You know, I try to, you know, engage people in these conversations, I've learned not to, like, bring it up, but people bring it up to me, and they'll ask me, you know, my perception on various things surrounding, you know, Christmas or Christianity, what have you. And then when I start to tell them, you know, what I know based on what I've read, you know, not in just one source, but in multiple sources, what I've heard from folks like yourself, they totally, and you can tell that they haven't been introduced to any of the literature that I reference. And so, but they totally, and these are, you know, seemingly intelligent folks, because when it comes to other things like with history or foreign policy, this, that, and the other, they'll reference, you know, treatises and books and articles that they've read, you know, over and almost ad nauseum. But then when it comes to this, you know, even when you present them with things that are counter to what they've been taught, and I try to tell them it's okay. I said that was based on the cell. It's based on the whole, you know, the cell. They have to have you know, bind to something. But why are you so adamant about not even looking into any of these books and to see if they line up with your own belief? Like, where do you think this is, like, to both of you guys? I know, you know, it doesn't matter to me which one of you guys takes it first, but how did this faith, and almost, I don't know if I'm going to say, like, blind faith, I guess I will, like, how does faith get such a strong hold of people's just kind of, like, critical thinking receptors, to the point that they just, when you present something like this, I mean, I can only imagine if you were the guest minister in one of these churches, Peter, you know, they probably, you know, boo you out of the place.
Absolutely.
Just based on, are you kidding me? What are you talking about? And even don't even go there, you know, with even telling them that Jesus, you know, wasn't blonde haired and blue eyed. I mean, they'd probably tie you to a stake and burn you alive. But where did this come from? Like, how did this come about? And if it's such a stronghold, you know, can it even be broken? And I'll end on this. And I know it's like a loaded question, but then it delves into that kind of loaded answer that you put out there, Peter, with the Christmas tree and even with Dester referencing Santa Claus. These so-called Christian households, their kids know more about Santa Claus than this celebration of the very day, you know what I'm saying, that Santa Claus is supposed to be bringing these gifts, and they know more about this guy, this mythological character called Santa Claus bringing them gifts in the still of the night, more so than they do about the so-called birth date of Jesus Christ itself.
Yeah, that is really a timely question, particularly at Christmas time. And you're right on point, Solomon, when you talk about the inability for Americans in general and Christians in particular to critically think. And just as a sidebar, that's where my colleague and I, Dr. Reggie Turner, we've created an organization called the Academy of Critical Thinking, because we recognize that through the course of our work together and our ministry together, that particularly in the church, folks just stop thinking. And the reason that has been, by and large, is that the church has been telling folks it's about faith. You know, it's about what you believe. And so to delve too deeply into critical thinking and to critical exploration of factual history is a almost an act of disobedience or a demonstration of a lack of faith. And so critical thinking has never been encouraged in the church. In fact, it's discouraged in many churches, particularly the black church, and that's just been disastrous for the black church. Cain Hope Felder, and for those of you that aren't familiar with Cain Hope Felder, I highly recommend him to you, particularly when it comes to exploring some of the black presence in the Bible Hanno Felders has some powerful books that I want to commend to you and your listeners there, Solomon. But he calls the black church pre-critical. He considers the black church, by and large, to have a pre-critical stance towards the Bible and towards biblical history. In other words, they're not at a point where they're actually thinking critically about the text itself and all of the extra-biblical literature out there that helps inform us on the factual history of not just Jesus and the Jesus movement, but all that led up to Jesus. And that's going back to at the top of the show when I mentioned the context. We have to look at the Jesus movement in context. We have to look at the significance of Christmas in its larger context, the significance of the birth of Jesus, that is, in its larger historical and social context. Otherwise, it has no meaning. And so what has happened, Solomon, over the centuries is that there has been a growing disconnect between the real social context of the Jesus movement and all that led up to it. And I'm talking about everything back from, you know, Moses leading the Israelites out of Egypt, and the prophets speaking their fiery words to the Israelite people, all the way up to the Maccabean Revolt, which is the background for the Jewish celebration of Hanukkah. And you won't find that in the traditional Old Testament or New Testament. And we can come back to that. But all of that leading up to the Jesus movement, all that stuff has been basically ignored. And so there's been a movement to eliminate critical thinking. And like I said, it's been particularly disastrous in the black church, because the black church has, by and large, adopted almost wholesale Western white theology and has become virtually just a version of white Christianity in the white church. And that's a, again, that's disastrous, and it's been disastrous for black Americans ever since they reached this country. But we see the mythology of Christmas, and it takes root and it takes hold. And looking at our cultural context, it's important for critical thinking to be sidelined. You know, we don't want folks to think critically about the war against Iraq and the war on Afghanistan. We don't want people to think critically about presidential politics. We don't want people to think too critically and too deeply. And so what we're seeing in terms of the lack of critical thinking towards Christmas, the lack of critical thinking in the church, is just symptomatic of a larger malaise in our culture at large, in terms of the American mindset, is not one to be critical towards pretty much everything and anything. I mean, you think about the soundbite culture that we live in and the TV culture that we live in. It's not a culture that is used to critical thinking. And that is a perfect way for the apparatus, the powers that be, the domination system, if you will, to continue to tell us lies and to continue to lead us in ways that lead to our own destruction. And so it's the same type of process that's happened in larger culture, this lack of critical thinking. And to be honest with you, I don't know how to jumpstart it, but that's something that, that Dr. Turner and I are trying to undertake, is to try to jumpstart a process of critical thinking at some level, to get people thinking critically, to look at factual history. And the church is a great place to start, because the church has the background, the prophetic impulse, if you will, to become a real change agent in this culture. Unfortunately, it has abandoned that impulse and given up that call, and has become, as we all well know, basically a bedfellow of capitalism, and is acting more as a tool of oppression. You know, Marx called it the opiate of the people, and he was right on point when he described religion that way. And so, you know, we definitely need to explore how to get people thinking critically about the Jesus movement, about religion, and about other things as well.
Right. Yeah, and I want to go and add to that. First off, I want to give another, common saying that if you can't beat them, join them. And that's exactly what the Roman Church did with Christianity. For the most part, I want to say that what they've done, the powers that be have done, is taught people how to think. One thing that has been very, very dangerous and detrimental to people has been a literal interpretation of text. One thing that you will learn if you study ancient traditions is that nothing was actually taken literally. Everything that was written was actually written in a very metaphoric way. And the way of teaching in ancient times was a way of speaking in parables and proverbs and having people to actually figure it out themselves. Now, another thing I want to also clarify is that Jesus wasn't actually the name of the person. The real name is Yeshua. Jesus is a Greek name. Yeshua, it actually translates to Joshua in English. And Yeshua means Yahweh is salvation. Yahweh is actually the name of one of the names of the Hebrew God that they translate now as Jehovah. But the letter J didn't. It actually didn't exist until like the 14th century or so. So it was a Y, Yahweh, and now it's Jehovah. But anyway, the way that Yeshua taught was all in parables. Everything was all about parables and getting people to understand and look past a literal interpretation of the text. And so the parables were actually the key to understanding everything. And even the whole story is actually a parable, if you take a look at it, and what each thing represents. I mean, it's not really my job to go and break down every single thing, but if you actually take a look at it, it mirrors a lot of the other stories of some of the other teachers and so-called God men that have walked the planet, some like Heru, who's now known as Horus, Krishna, Buddha, or whatnot. It talks about birth, ascension, death, and resurrection. And essentially, it's supposed to be a model for us to follow, to live. But what the powers that be have done is that they've gone and took it, and they turned these metaphoric things into literal things, and have gone and repackaged it and presented it to us in a very different way. So rather than Yeshua and being a metaphor for us, or this the story being a metaphor for us, now this is a literal story and we have to go and follow it to a T. Or another thing that they've done, and this is very, very, very important, is they've gone and essentially they scared people into believing in what they want to give you, and they've given you a consequence. So they talk about a heaven or a hell, and the European creation of hell was actually one of the main things that they used to go and scare people to believing in what they want, in their theology. But interesting enough, it says in Luke 17:20-21, in regards to heaven, and he said, when he was demanded of the Pharisees when the kingdom of God should come, he answered them and said, the kingdom of God come not with observation, neither shall they say, lo here or lo there, for behold, the kingdom of God is within you. So, even in the story, it's actually saying that you have to go and look at heaven as a metaphor for something inside of you. And even with hell, he said, I can't remember the exact verse, but he said, don't fear that the one who can kill the body but can't kill the soul, rather fear the one who can kill both body and soul in hell. Or actually, the word translates as Gehenna. And so you talk about killing both body and soul. Obviously, you can only kill the body and soul if you're still alive. So that's a metaphoric state. It's a state of being. It's something that you experience in life, not in death. But what they've gone and done is they've turned everything upside down, and they've repackaged it. And they do the same thing over and over in history. As you can see with Martin Luther King, they've gone and turned a very complex figure into I love everyone, hold hands, sing kumbaya, type fellow, because the message was so strong that, for the most part, they know human nature. Human nature will reject anything that's outright wrong. So what they do is they go and mix in, they throw in a lot of lies with the truth, and so a lot of people can't tell the difference. And I think one reason it has such a strong hold on us is, you know, going back to the Matrix. The Matrix, I think, is a very good example. You know, people are trapped in the Matrix, and they get very comfortable. And they get so dependent on the system. And that's why the system is designed for, to make you dependent on it. And they're so dependent on the system that anything that goes against it, they'll fight it just to go and maintain, you know, the system, the Matrix, as you will. So that's really what it's created. Is, you know, a Matrix has been created with us. And now we don't know right from wrong. We don't know truth from we don't know reality from fantasy. We don't know metaphor from history. And this is a very dangerous thing. So now you have a lot of people running around saying all sorts of crazy things that aren't meant to be taken literal, you know, and they're going to be, it's going to be a rude awakening when they actually find out that these things aren't actually real. They're fighting for things that didn't really happen. A lot of these characters aren't, you know, flesh and blood beings. And I would actually have to say this. It might actually come off as being offensive to some people, but, you know, Jesus Christ and Santa Claus are actually both mythological beings. And when you take a look at the definition of what mythology is mythology is like a story or folklore that's often based off of real events. Now, Jesus might be a mythological character because you're not going to find someone that was really born on the 25th and that did all these great things and that went to, you know, that was crucified and raised 3 days afterward and so, and then sent into heaven 40 days later. You're not going to find someone with that biography, but you're going to find characters or, you know, a character or characters that inspired that legend. It's a legend. Same with Santa Claus. There actually wasn't a real Santa Claus, but there was a St. Nicholas who inspired the legend or the myth of Santa Claus. And that goes for a lot of different things. You know, mythology can be inspired not only by real people, but by phenomenon and nature. For example, Hercules. Hercules wasn't a real person, but the story of Hercules is actually the same story. It was actually inspired by the same thing that inspired the story of Samson, the sun. Hercules is actually a metaphor for the sun, the same way as Samson is a metaphor for the sun. But a lot of other characters are actually natural phenomena that's been personified and is used to tell a story in a way that people can understand. And so, like I said in the beginning, you know, when you go and make people believe that mythology is history, history and mythology, you know, that's when all sorts of chaos and craziness happens, and that's exactly what has been going on for a good 2,000 years now.
And that chaos leading, and Peter, I want you to touch upon this. I mean, when Dessa, when you refer to that chaos, you know, and that chaos, quite frankly, you know, I would say has, you know, without a doubt, cost a lot of people, you know, their freedom. It took this sting out of them from resisting, you know, deleterious, like evil things that Europeans did to Africans, you know, through chattel slavery, and you know, it was, as you alluded, as both of you guys alluded, it was taken and you had some, you know, so-called racist, you know, some so-called theologians, these racist theologians, you know, twisting the words, the stories, you know, what have you, from the Bible to suit their own benefit. But then when Africans were stolen from, you know, from their homeland and brought over to Turtle Island, otherwise known as North America, Christianity was used, you know, because I always like to try to clarify, folks. I said Christianity was resold and repackaged to them in a way to pacify them, because, you know, when you look at David Allen, or you look at even, you know, contemporary like Dr. James Cohen, who are of the Black Liberation Theology, you can see where they used the Bible in a totally different way, in a totally different way that was different than the repackaging that white Europeans used to pacify so many African slaves for such a long, long time to this point today, where, you know, they no longer need chains to enslave many of us, you know, inside and outside the church. But, you know, you look at David Allen and what he was able to do within his congregation to inspire folks to fight. And I'm glad you brought up, you know, Dr. King, who has been, who each year is repackaged, more and more each year. I mean, and it's not even, you know, unfortunately, it's no longer not even just January 19th where he repackaged, and unfortunately, it's no longer just white politicians that repackage him. I mean, Barack Obama, you know, just you know, about a week ago when he accepted his undeserved Peace Prize in Copenhagen, he referenced how he was inspired by Dr. King. I'm like, how dare you talk about how you were inspired by Dr. King to become who you are? Because Dr. King said any nation that spends more money on military than it does on programs for social uplift is headed for spiritual doom. So, Peter, what was, if you can tell us, what was Black liberation theology and how did it inspire so many American-born Africans and as well as enslaved Africans to really rise up and fight? And also on the other hand, how was it used to pacify so many folks as well?
Point your questions, Solomon. And, you know, Black liberation theology or Black theology is best articulated and was first formally articulated by Dr. James Cone. He came out with a trilogy of books beginning in 1969 that articulated Black theology and Black liberation theology. And so I commend any of his readings to you. And Black theology is largely a corrective on white theology, white Western theology that had been co-opted by the powers that be, by the domination system, and had been used to exploit whatever underclass suited the purposes of the overclasses. And obviously, with slavery in North America, you know, we have to understand that there's been a systematic attempt to eradicate Blackness and Africanity from the biblical record and from the history of Christianity, you know, for over 500 years, for most of the formative period of Western culture and Western Christianity, particularly American culture and American Christianity. So what Black theology is and what we're trying to get at is damage control, so to speak, you know, correcting an egregious wrong of misinterpretation, intentional misinterpretation, motivated largely by racism and white supremacy. You know, European culture in general and the European or Roman Christianity in particular was whitewashing history, you know, including Old and New Testament biblical history. And it was rewritten, misinterpreted to justify the oppressive systems, and if we look at old Europe, the pre-capitalist systems that motivated slavery, and when it, you know, hit North America in full force and became capitalism and began to evolve into what we know it today, you know, it needed human resources. And so Christianity was one way to kind of brainwash people to the masses to justify the slavery of people of color. You know, slavery is a pretty objectionable type of thing for most people. And so a system, an ideology had to be developed in order to justify that. And so, you know, the system of white supremacy and racism, those doctrines and ideologies were developed specifically to placate, you know, the white masses in Europe and then later in the United States to say that, you know what, Africans in general and people of color worldwide are subhuman. And so the church adopted those ideologies and folded them into their theologies. And so, you know, this goes on for centuries. And, you know, you had slave owners, you had white slave owners who, you know, were sitting up in church on Sundays, many of them deacons and elders and even ministers. And then they were, you know, owning slaves and trading in human beings all along the way and not seeing that as incompatible. So Black theology comes along as a corrective to say, you know, there is a stream of the Jesus movement that that black theology embraces and exalts as the liberation of oppressed people. And that's exactly where Jesus was and who Jesus was, the historical Jesus. You know, Dustin mentioned the mythological character that Jesus has taken on, and he's right on point because, you know, this Jesus Christ character is nothing like Jesus of Nazareth in history. And so, you know, black theology and black liberation theology looks at the Jesus movement and the authentic Jesus and the impulse of liberation that is so clear in the Jesus movement and tries to draw a parallel between the oppressed Jesus and the oppressed Jewish peasantry who Jesus was part of and lived and moved amongst, and black America. That's why James Cone says Jesus is black, because the parallel in contemporary Western culture, in fact globally, we could say honestly globally, is that the person of the black man or woman is the oppressed, the wretched of the earth, to borrow a term from Paulo Freire. And so that is the corrective that black theology attempts to make. You know, and just anecdotally, you mentioned how, you know, I would get run out of a church by bringing some of this knowledge in. True story, the last church that I had the opportunity to pastor at, I said some pretty radical things, and it ruffled some feathers. But I'll tell you what upset people the most was when I took the pictures of their blue-eyed, blonde-haired Jesus off the wall.
And this was a black church.
Well, it had been a historically white church, but it was in a transitional urban neighborhood, and so most of the neighborhood was becoming Latino and African American. And the membership had dwindled. So I was asked to come in and try to rejuvenate the church and turn it into an urban church that reflected the composition of the neighborhood. And as I did that, you know, it was clear that what the folks were saying, you know, they wanted to be inclusive. They weren't really serious about it. You know, what they said with their mouth and with their lips wasn't backed up by their actions, because they were clearly uncomfortable with the browning of their congregation, if you will. And then the last straw was, you know, literally, I was taking down these pictures of blonde-haired, blue-eyed white Jesus, because that mythological character is just so entrenched, so ingrained in the majority mindset in white America, that to begin to deconstruct that is it's highly upsetting, you know. And so, you know, we see the backlash. I mean, look at how demonized Jeremiah Wright is now in popular culture. And, you know, this is a brother who did nothing but tell the truth. You know, I attended his church for a while when I was in Chicago, and I'll tell you what, you know, there are some phenomenal things going on at Trinity UCC in Chicago, and he's retired from there now, but that church was a dynamic, transformative congregation in urban Chicago, and Jeremiah Wright was a wonderful teacher, an outstanding preacher, just a tremendous tremendous man. But he comes up and he says something that's contrary to the American narrative, to the American mythology, and he's automatically demonized.
Right.
So anything that runs contrary to the narrative, or to use Dustin's term, you know, the mythology, folks are going to get highly upset. Folks become irate about that, you know, and the reasons for that and the sources of that, I can't claim to understand it. I really can't.
Right.
But I think it gets at the fabric of, you know, who people think they are and how they feel about themselves and their sense of self. And when we start to speak the truth, and it contradicts the mindset and the reality and the narrative that we've built up for ourselves over lifetimes and over generations, I can see how that can be unsettling for some people. So the truth
right.
about Christmas, the truth about Christianity, is in fact very unsettling for people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I actually wanted to get more into it, especially the African
the African origins of it. And I definitely do commend those who are part of the, you know, reformist Christianity and those who are about liberation Christianity, because that's really what it's supposed to do. And as far as, like, the whole Old and New Testament, yeah, Christianity, just like every other religion, had its roots in Africa, because Africa is the mother of civilization. That's where the first humans came from. And so all religions are actually based off of that, both Old and New Testament. And a lot of the stories in the Old Testament, it's not that they actually feature black characters, but they're actually based off of black characters. Old Testament is another form of mythology. Not to say that the stories didn't happen, but it's just that they were based off of actual people and actual stories that did, in fact, happen. If you take a look at them, you know, the story of Noah's Ark is very, very similar to that you find in an old Mesopotamian tale called Enuma Elish.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Even in Hindu's Kush, they have different stories that are very similar to those found in Genesis. And so, yeah, the Genesis is actually in Africa. So when you talk about the Hebrew people and the people of Canaan, and, you know, you can't ignore Sumer, the black civilization that was there first, and Canaan, who was there afterwards. And when you talk about them going to Egypt, you can't leave with all the stories to take away from it. It seems like, you know, the Bible can't get away from Egypt. The so-called Israelites were supposed to have spent a couple of generations there. Jesus even was supposed to have been there in his youth in the story. And so, I mean, it's something that you really just can't escape from. And once you actually delve into it and you reach an inescapable conclusion that it is actually a lot of African traditions that are repackaged yet again and sold as something else. So you have the Old Testament, what we call Judaism today, and, you know, you have both Jews and Christians saying amen at the end of their prayers.
Exactly.
And, you know, if you take a look at Egyptian mythology, the symbol amen was a symbol of God. It's, in fact, one of the symbols of one of the states of God. And the word for God, that it actually means hidden, sin unconceivable. And so when you have different parts of it, so you have Amenta was supposed to be the underworld, and then Amen-Ra was the world that you've seen. So the seen world was Amen-Ra, the unseen world, the underworld was Amenta. And what you call the so-called Ark of the Covenant was actually the bark of Amen, or the bark of Amen-Ra. And so they carried a lot of different things. Moses is actually an Egyptian name. It's not a Hebrew name. It means son of. So you have different kings of Egypt, you know, called Thutmose or Amos or something. So they're son of a particular god or son of someone else. And so that went along. And so a lot of these different things you find, they're not just coincidences. They are things that were taken from Africa and repackaged. And the Jesus story is definitely one of them. The Jesus story has a lot of its characteristics derived from the story of Heru and Osir. One thing about our so-called Western civilization is that it has its roots primarily in Greek, you know, in the Greek civilization. In fact, some Western scholars are foolish enough to say that the Greek civilization was the first civilization, which is very, very untrue. I don't know where they got that crazy idea from. But the thing about Greek civilization is that the Greeks, ancient Greeks, well, actually there was no real Greek civilization. They were actually very city states, and they called themselves different things, Dardanians and other different names, but never Greeks, you know, Athenians. Yeah, they gave a lot of love to Egypt, or Egypt, as you call it now, was actually known by different names. One of the names was Tameri, which means the beloved land.
Kemet.
Yeah, Kemet, the land of the blacks. And And so they gave a lot of love to Egypt as being, you know, some of their great teachers. And a lot of the Greek gods were actually based off Egyptian gods. So you have Aphrodite, which is based off the goddess Heru. You have an Apollo, who is based off the goddess, one of the gods, Heru. You have Ares, who's based off of Hera Kahuti. Zeus is actually Amen. And, you know, it goes so on and so on. And so the Greeks took a lot of different things and repackaged them to, you know, as their own religion. And the same thing happened with the Romans. The Romans actually took the Greek gods and repackaged them. And so, yeah, this whole repackaging thing has been going on for a very long time. And so, essentially, a lot of the elements from the Heru story. Heru is more commonly known as Horus, and Osir is more commonly known as Osiris, found their way into the Jesus story. And actually, I think we have enough time for me to actually go briefly through the story.
And quickly, we have about 5 minutes left before I close with the little song that I want to send out to the listeners. But I want to give you guys a couple minutes to give your contact information, because you guys have gotten into like such in-depth stuff, and it's been such a great show. I actually want to open the door to having another show in the not-so-distant future. But I'd love for Desta, if you could give the link to your radio show, as well as your contact information in terms of your email address, and definitely Peter, if you could give your email address, because I'm sure there's people who are listening and people that are going to listen that this is going to be just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what is like new to them. And so, I would love for them to have the opportunity to reach out to you guys, contact you guys and build with you guys and even, you know, maybe even bring you guys into their organization for a talk or something like that.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah, I guess we will probably need another show just to go into the whole story and where all the different elements come from. But my show page, my show is called Igbo Kwenu Radio, and you can just type it in www.blogtalkradio.com/Igbo Kwenu, and the way you spell that is IGBO and then KWENU, that's Igbo Kwenu, and my email is DESPAANY@gmail.com, and we repeat, is D as in David, E as in Edward, S as in Sam, T as in Thomas, 2 A's as in Adam, N as in Nancy, and then Y as in Yellow @gmail.com.
Thanks. And Peter?
My name is Peter Fowler, and my organization, along with my colleague Reggie Turner, is the Academy of Critical Thinking. You can find us at theactinc.org. That's theactinc.org. And I can be reached at peter.fowler@theactinc.org. That's PETER.FOWLER. And alternatively, peter.fowler@yahoo.com.
And I want to thank both of you guys, and I look forward to having you guys on again. And I want to tell the listeners, please make sure you reach out to these brothers, because they've got a wealth of information. We've just tipped into the iceberg. We've just touched on the tip of the iceberg. And next time, you know, they come on, we can get, you know, more into things that they were talking about, you know, because we didn't even, you know, get a chance to even touch on the book of the coming forth by day and by night. There's a lot of scholars that have delved into this stuff, like Dr. Ben Yakinen in New York, the great legendary John Henry Clark even has done research around African origins of Christianity. And so we're definitely going to have you guys on again. And, you know, I really want to, you know, use this show as a platform to the next show, because, Peter, you brought up something really, really important. So did you, Desta, in terms of the whole repackaging, because this is what we see in American society. And Peter, you touched on something in terms of how the white folks in that congregation were not willing, you know what I'm saying, even though they consider themselves benevolent and they were ready to prophesize, you know, the blacks and Latino in their community. But when it came to looking at things logically, that this character, this individual historically, you know,
would not be blonde-haired and blue-eyed. And when you try to put in some, you know, the actual more accurate representation of Jesus Christ, you know, or Yeshua, they weren't ready for that. And that's to me, that story that you told is very endemic of U.S. Of American society in general.
Yeah,
same way we're not ready to get rid of these bullshit, you know, holidays such as Columbus Day, you know, based on that, oh, they've always existed, but this guy was a murderer, a rapist, a plunderer. You know, we have cities and schools named after Andrew Jackson, the raving racist, Native American killer. And so, you know, even, you know, these folks have been fed to us, you know, such as George Washington owned over 300, you know, African slaves. And so, you know, I really want to use this this conversation, this dialogue in Christianity and religion in general to really touch on things that exist in American society that many Americans are not even, when it even just comes to even like looking at things in a more humane way and giving, which would bring us, what I would say, closer to compassion, which brings you closer to humanity when you are able to understand, you know, why indigenous folks would not be down with the last Thursday of the month of November or the second Monday of October and these types of things. And so until we as a nation come to grips with these things, we will continue to not be this level playing field or this so-called melting pot. It will continue to be an American nightmare.
That's right.
What El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, you know, otherwise known as Malcolm X, said. So I want to thank you guys both, and thank you for the listeners. And I'm, yeah.
Can I make one last statement in regards to the whole image of Jesus?
All right.
Oh, yeah. People are really uncomfortable with the image of Jesus being, they're really comfortable with the image of Jesus being a blue-eyed, blonde-haired white man. But it might actually shock a lot of people to know that Jesus was actually, he would actually look just like a Palestinian, because the Palestinians are actually the real children of Israel. Those are the real descendants of the Jews that are spoken of in the Bible. And so the people that are claiming Israel right now are actually the real imposters, and that's the real mythology that's going on there, this whole idea. I think a lot of people would be shocked to know that the person who they claim to be worshiping and serving looks like a Palestinian who they're actually helping to kill and murder.
Yeah,
right.
You're right.
Right, definitely. And so thank you so much, and that's a very good point to end on, and I'll see you guys on Monday. We have another show coming up on Monday. This Monday, the 28th of December, we'll be joined by Abiyomi Ezekwe from Pan African Newswire. We'll be talking about AFRICOM, the illegal invasion of an illegal war in Iraq, Afghanistan, and also the so-called covert war fought by the CIA in Pakistan, and various issues occurring right now in sub-Saharan Africa. And Karis One is going to take us out with a very apropos song called Higher Level.
Sure.
Once again, thank you to Peter Fowler and Desta Anuo and you, the listener. This is Solomon signing off for Your The World News, and here is Karis One.
One, two, 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 two. Public service announcement for all the people out there listening to this funky-ass boom bap album. Check it out. Take a second. Just
to the truth and don't get mad at me. No politician can give you peace. If you trust Jesus, why do you vote for a beast? Emancipation is long overdue, so it becomes procrastination, because freedom is within you. For some reason, we think we're free, so we'll never be, because we haven't recognized slavery. You're still a slave, look at how you behave, debating on where and when and how and what master gave. You want to know how we screwed up from the beginning? We accepted our oppressor's religion. So in the gates of slavery, it ain't hard, because it's right in the eyes of their God. Where is our God? The God that represents us. The God that looks like me, the God that I can trust. A God of peace and love, not mass hysteria. I don't want a God that blesses America. I can never really vote for the devil. Let me take you to a higher level. From off the front of the Bible, God don't live there. Too many inconsistencies, too many mysteries. Picture the Pope in the Vatican laughing and drinking and singing against me. I stand with God, whether I'm paid or whether I'm crying broke. I like to ask these politicians, would Jesus vote? The way we view God is a freaking shame. Church is to blame. We trust God, but wrong and sane. We simply loving the scripture. Take scripture that whips you, sooner it'll hit you. Religion's getting richer. With that European version of Christ made into a picture, our society's getting sicker and sicker. Like liquor, we are God intoxicated. Not to the true God, but the one the government created. The same government's telling people to vote. I pray to God because the people have lost hope. You either vote for the mumps or the measles. Whether you vote for the lesser of two evils, you vote for evil. Politics and God are not equal, but the education they get on God is really lethal. People have more respect for a holy book than they do for a cow on a meat hook. Believers of Jesus be denouncing Satan on every level, but every Halloween they're dressing like devil. I pray to you for the light you might give them. Mother makes them know that you're living within them. You begin them and end them in silence, frankly. If they knew you, they would understand violence. I pray to you for the Pope and the Vatican. Have mercy, Mother, because I know that you're mad at them. The white Jesus deceived us a while ago, and Pope Julius II paid Michelangelo. I know this happened in 1519, yet this is the image we can't seem to forget. Vote for God, don't vote for the devil. Let me take you.